Welcome to The Auction Brief.
There's a joy to this game, is there not?
Taking you on a journey through fantasy football, the law, and life.
This is all yours to take. Depends on how much you want.
And now, your legal analyst and auction draft expert, here to help you dominate your fantasy drafts, your host, Drew Davenport.
Clear eyes, full hearts.
Let's go play some football. Let's go, baby!
Hey, everybody. Welcome into the Auction Brief. Once again, we are on the mic this week with episode 36. Holy smokes, it is already just a couple weeks away from the biggest draft weekend of the year, Labor Day, which is just 1 week ahead of the NFL season. So we're about a month out from the NFL season. We've only got a couple episodes of the Auction Brief left for this draft season. As always, as the lady said, I'm your host, Drew Davenport. And you can find me over on Twitter at Drew Davenport FF, on TikTok at Fantasy Football Lawyer. And don't forget, I'm with Underdog this summer. Use the promo code AUCTION and get $100 of free money. They've been running some really cool contests, just $3 contests with $50,000 in prizes. And best of all, no rake on that baby. They call it the Pomeranian because it's only $3. And I got in the regular Pomeranian, but then they had a super flex. And oh man, so much fun. Get over to Underdog, use my promo code AUCTION. Don't forget that we are only on the air because of the generosity of Steve Rappin, Brian Drake, and the folks at Fighting Chance Fantasy. So head over to their page right now. They've got some great content coming out. I'm in the Fighting Chance internal chat, and I see them talking about the content they have coming. It sounds like it's going to be a great finish to the draft season. So head over to FightingChanceFantasy.com and check that out. I want to thank the aforementioned Steve Rappin because, as you may or may not know, I've talked about it maybe once this summer, but Canton was last weekend. Who's tired of Canton? Raise your hand if you're tired of hearing about the Fantasy Football Expo. Well, you got to hear about it for one more week, and then we're done. Sad. We're already done. I looked forward to it for 364 days. From the day after last year, and it's already over. Oh, so sad. But I want to talk about Steve Rappin real quick and just say thank you. Once again, Steve bought me dinner on the opening night we were there to thank me for being a part of Fighting Chance Fantasy. Can't thank him enough for that. Just what a great guy. Thank you, Steve. You know, Steve is putting me on the air, doing me the favor, and yet he buys me dinner every year. I'm not sure how that works. But thanks, Steve, and the folks at Fighting Chance Fantasy. I just want to say real quick that the Fantasy Football Expo weekend was everything I wanted it to be. It was absolutely awesome. I had to miss the cornhole tournament because my poker tournament went a little bit long, but hey, it was a great event. And I just want to say, first of all, thank you to Joe Bryant with Football Guys for providing the money for having such a great event on Friday afternoon. It was a perfect kickoff to the weekend. We called it the icebreaker, and it really was. We had a bar in there. People came in, hung out. We had music going, food came out, door prizes. The atmosphere was great. I think it went awesome. Thank you to everybody who came and to the so many people who came up to me during the weekend and said, hey, man, great event. I loved it. Or I want to play again next year. Or, hey, I heard your event was awesome. To all those people, thank you so much. It just was an awesome way to spend the weekend to have you all coming up to me and telling me how great the event was. I had a blast. It was a little bit nuts. I still can't even believe I finished in fourth. Oh, yeah, that's right. If you didn't go, you wouldn't know. But I finished in fourth, 62 people. That sounds great, right? Except that I just really didn't get any cards. I just won a couple all-ins and kind of hung around. Finally ended up getting in with pocket fours to pocket fives when I was real short. And, of course, that didn't work out. So here I am in fourth place. But no big deal. It was an awesome event. A couple other shout-outs on that event. My friend Zach came to the event from near Youngstown where he lives, you know, a childhood friend of mine who's been hooked up with the Auction Brief this summer and given me a lot of great feedback. Zach came to the event and he stuck around to the end, helping clean up, shuffle, just a jack of all trades, just doing anything that I needed. And I just have to say, without Zach, it would have been a much rougher afternoon. So thank you, Zach. And I really appreciate you being there. And I'm glad we got to hang out a little bit, even though we didn't get to talk too much. Two other guys I want to mention, Mike Schopp and Sean Stutzman. Thank you guys so much for your help. Sean dealt the final table. He was magnificent. Mike stuck around to shuffle and help out as we got later in the tournament. So thank you so much for that. And one other thank you before we move into some content for the week. Thank you to all the people who came up and introduced themselves at the expo this weekend. That was just awesome. I can't even really express how that feels because I've never felt it before. I mean, it was people just kept coming up and saying, hey, I love your content. I love your threads. I love this you're doing. I love that you're doing. It was amazing. It was so cool. And so many people that I just seen their name on the Twitter screen came to life this weekend. And unfortunately, the nature of the beast is that there's so many people out there that I wanted to talk to and hang out with. And I was really excited to talk to them, like JJ Winter. You know, JJ has become a good friend of mine. And congrats to JJ. He just got a job with IDP guys here this week. But, you know, I kept coming up to him and like talking to him for like 30 seconds. And then I would get pulled in another direction. And same thing with my buddy Jesse Morse, the fantasy doctor. Love hanging out with Jesse. Look forward to hanging out with him again this year after having so much fun with him last year. Didn't feel like I got a lot of time with him, but you know, a lot of new friends, reconnecting with some old friends. It was an amazing, amazing weekend. And I just can't stress enough how much I appreciate all of you coming up and introducing yourselves. Thank you so much. It meant a lot to me, and I will never forget it. All right, let's put a wrap on Canton with that last thank you. We are going to talk about the Kings Classic draft, but that's not really about Canton. I hope that's going to be beneficial for you to hear about a real life auction that I went through against really tough players. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to hit that almost exclusively. My guest this week is Doug Orth from FF Today. And Doug was in the Blanda room with me doing the auction. And Doug had a great draft. He did a nice job. I respect his auction game. And it's one of the reasons I asked him to come on this week for discussions with Drew, because I thought we would talk about the draft. And I thought that you would get a lot out of that going into your drafts. So let's get into a little bit of content for the week. I think that's enough of an intro. I've been talking a little bit longer than I want to in the intro, but I thought all that stuff was really important. We haven't had a legal update in a little while because not a lot has been happening, but I think it's important to hit a couple developments this week, and it can be a real short and sweet one, but I do want to hit a legal update real quick and talk about some developments from the past 10 days.
Now it's time for your legal update.
First of all, just a quick update on Alvin Kamara. Nothing has happened in the case, so there isn't necessarily an update on a punishment or whatnot, but something really interesting happened in that Adam Schefter came out and said that it's looking more and more unlikely that Kamara will be suspended this season. And I hate to toot my own horn, but beep, beep, toot, toot. Wasn't that the great philosopher R. Kelly who sang beep, beep, toot, toot? I don't know who said that, but anyway, I've been saying this for a while on Kamara. It's nice to have Adam Schefter backing me up there. I mean, he didn't credit me, so I don't know what that's all about, so I'm going to have to, you know, get in his ear about that. But seriously, with the Kamara case, it is looking more and more unlikely that he's going to be suspended. His ADP continues to rise, so pay attention to that. And again, understand the caveats that I set up in the past on Twitter about the video and about whether or not he takes a plea deal near the end of the season. It's still a volatile situation, but it's starting to look more and more stable as we get closer to the season. And certainly, an endorsement from Adam Schefter is not a bad thing. The next thing would be, of course, the Deshaun Watson case, which is still hanging out there. We're still waiting for a decision on the appeal. But a couple of things happened that I wanted to talk about. Number one is that Watson's team, I'm sure, I don't know this, but Watson's team, I believe, leaked that he was willing to take 8 games and a $5 million fine. And the reason I think that's significant is because at this point, it sounds to me like maybe they sense there's a crack in the NFL's facade and they wanted to get it out in the media that Watson would accept this. I think that's pretty important, and I think that it's noteworthy because it's combined with point number two, which is that before the Browns preseason game this past weekend, Watson was interviewed by admittedly a friendly reporter that's friendly with the Browns, but he was interviewed and he took the chance to apologize for his behavior. That is a big deal. Now, a lot of people are saying to me, well, it's too late and it wasn't sincere. And I get it. I don't care what your opinion of the apology itself is. My point in highlighting it is that it portends a change in the case going forward. Because up until this point, he hasn't been able to admit that he did anything wrong. And now he's saying, hey, I feel like my actions were inappropriate and I wish I had it back. So that's an interesting change. Whether or not you believe him, I don't care. Okay, that's up to you. You can decide that. But the point is, that is a change in his attitude, which says to me that, again, that maybe they think there's a crack in the facade of the NFL to be able to settle this thing. So he came out and said, I'll take eight games and $5 million. And, oh, yeah, I'm sorry. And another thing he said in that interview that was really interesting that people are glossing over is that he has been undergoing counseling. Now, this is funny because this is what I do every day for a living. And I said last May that if his legal team could get him to apologize and get into counseling or maybe go on a speaking tour or something like that, that he could settle all these cases and have this thing done by July. And he'd be fine and maybe, subjected to a small punishment from the NFL. But he could have worked all this stuff out a year and a half ago. He chose not to do so. He was stubborn. And I don't know if that was his legal team's advice or if he was stubborn. I have my suspicions. But the bottom line is, this is a big shift. He is admitting that he's in counseling. He's apologized. And he's leaking out there that he'll take a settlement. I think this thing is hurtling down the tracks towards a settlement, although I could be wrong about that because we could get a decision on the appeal any day. So it just sure feels like it's falling in that realm that I was talking about before, and that the NFL can say they got more than half a game or half a season if they can get 9 or 10 games out of this. So that feels like where it is headed. But that's your update. We know now that Watson is starting to toe the line in the mitigation realm. So that may portend a shift in the case that leads to the conclusion of the Deshaun Watson saga. All right, let's move on to a little bit of fantasy football content. What do you say? We're in the height of draft season, and I want you to hear about a really interesting draft that I took place in this past weekend. And something happened that reminded me about how far I have to go with auction drafting. And that doesn't mean that I'm sitting here and saying, oh, I'm no good at auction drafting. I'm terrible at auctions. That's not what I mean. You always have something you can learn. And I've said that all along. You know this about me. You'd never come out of an auction draft and have a perfect draft. It's never going to be perfect. So there's always something to learn. And I started thinking about how far I have to come because a couple things happened in the Kings Classic that frustrated me because I didn't see them coming or because my analysis of the coming situation was wrong for one reason or another. And after the fact, it became real simple as to why I was wrong, but I saw it after the fact. And what good does that do me? So let me talk a little bit about what triggered that thought in my head. And I'll talk about those situations that I think I got wrong. I was listening to a podcast about leadership. Somebody was talking about, it wasn't strictly about that, but they were talking about leadership and they were talking about what it means to be a leader and not just telling people what to do. And this person was a coach of a basketball team. And she was saying, one of the things that makes up a good leader, the characteristics of a good leader, is being able to see things before they're going to happen. And she talked about reminders. And she says that the best point guards that she's ever had were point guards that would remind their teammates of things that were important in the current situation in the game. So coming out of the timeout. Okay, everybody, remember now, we got no timeouts left. We're out of timeouts. Don't try to call a timeout. Now, if somebody comes down the floor and calls a timeout, afterwards, you say, oh, come on, we didn't have any timeouts. Is that a leader? No, you're just bitching at that person. You're just whining because they made a mistake. If you were a leader, you would have said ahead of time, we don't have any timeouts. Okay, you're up by two late in the game, and you say, hey, get out on the shooters. Get out on the three-point line. Number six is going to shoot. get out on number six and don't let six have a shot from behind the arc. You don't say after six drains the three-pointer to beat you by one, oh, come on, you knew six was a shooter. You should have got out on him. That's whining. That's not leading. Leading is being out in front of it. And that's what triggered, well, let's just say it just triggered me in general a little bit. Because if I want to consider myself to be on the leading edge of auction drafting, I got to be better, right? I mean, I like my team, and I'm going to talk about why I like my team. But I'm also going to talk about how I kind of screwed up the chance to dominate a room full of analysts, a room full of really good drafters. I kind of screwed it up. And so it's a little frustrating. I still like my team. Don't get me wrong. I still gave myself like a B plus, maybe A minus, but I could have had an A plus draft. And isn't that what we're here for? We're here for the A plus. I don't give a crap if I get a B. Lots of people can get a B. So that's what kind of triggered me, because I was listening to this and thinking, man, if I really was the leader in the auction room, I would be able to predict what was going to happen instead of looking back and seeing what had happened and realizing how I was wrong. And unfortunately, what this means is that I'm going to put some more on your plate right now, because I just published my seventh part of my Mastering the Salary Cap Draft series over on Football Guys. Remember, you can find my writing over at Football Guys. And part seven is the final part in the series, and it's called inflection points. And we've talked about them numerous times, but inflection points are points in the draft when things shift and a new phase of the draft starts. There are opportunities to be had there. And what I've always talked about is notice when the inflection points hit and be ready to act. But the problem is you can't always act because you're not positioned correctly when the inflection point hits. And so what I want to put on your plate now, I'm piling something else on top of what you're supposed to be doing here, because I know that I tell you a lot of things that we're supposed to be doing, but we're going to be, you know, talking about this forever, because I believe that the way that we're attacking auction drafts and the way we've been talking about them this summer is the way you have to be going forward. Attack, attack, attack. Avoid mistakes, force others to make mistakes, and have the dogged determination to own the rest of the people in the room and finish the draft with the best draft in the room. So what does that have to do with leading and with understanding things ahead of time? Well, inflection points, it's okay if you can spot them, and that's half the battle. But the more important thing is predicting those shifts, because a lot of times you're not going to see them coming, and when they happen, you won't be able to take advantage of them because you're not ready. So predicting the shifts is more important. And I'm going to talk in a minute here about how I ended up with Aaron Jones instead of Joe Mixon, and there was a $6 difference in price. I was wrong about that, but, you know, that's how we learn, and I'm going to talk about what I learned. I think this concept is really, really key, and I think it applies perfectly to auction drafts. You must be able to predict the shifts in the room to be the most effective version of an auction drafter that you can be. That's the whole point. And that's what we've been leading to. And I feel like that's a great point for this far into the summer, because we've only got a couple episodes left. And if you take everything that you learned this summer, what it's supposed to be leading to is you being able to predict behavior and shifts in mood in the room. That seems like an amorphous, sort of nebulous blob of a concept, but that's why it's so hard. Also why it's so fun, but why it's so hard and challenging. Because predicting those shifts is difficult, and I failed to predict a couple of key moments in the draft on Saturday, and I'm going to tell you about those and why it matters so much.
Auction talk.
All right, when I was preparing for the show this week, I was thinking about how much I want to give away the secret sauce here. A lot of people in my leagues listen to this show, and there's a lot of people out there who are getting a peek behind the curtain for the first time. Now, some of you heard me talk about some of the stuff last summer, and I did some one-on-ones with people last summer where I helped people with par sheets and things like that. But I'm going to give you a little peek behind the curtain of what I went through when I was prepping for the Kings Classic. Now, don't forget, the Kings Classic is a unique league. It's a 14-teamer, and you start 10 position players. What that means is we don't have kickers, we don't have defenses, We start one quarterback, one tight end, and then you have to start eight position players between running back and wide receiver. You have two running backs, three wide receivers, and three flex. You're starting eight running back, wide receiver, or tight end. That is extremely deep and extremely difficult to get a team that doesn't have any holes. You have to have a much flatter build, and that's where I want to start with how I did my par sheet. I'm going to talk to you about now, right now, what was my plan, and did I execute it? I think the major piece of the puzzle in any auction plan is your par sheet. So what did I do when I was preparing for the draft? Well, the first thing I did was I opened up the Draft Dominator and looked at last year's results. I say this all the time, and I'm putting my money where my mouth is. This is how I prepare. I think it's an absolute must. Look back at last year, see what happened. In fact, I looked back at the last 2 years since we expanded to 14 teams and 10 spots in your lineup. And what I realized was that I got a little bit lucky last year to win because I had Devontae Adams and Austin Eckler that both went for over $40, and they managed to stay healthy, and I managed to find a few late-round gems. So I think I got a little bit lucky last year, and that really colored the idea behind my par sheet for this year because I didn't want to have to go out of the draft drafting my last three or four players at $1 or $2. We only have a six bench allowance, so we've got 10 players in our starting lineup, but only six on our bench, and that's tough. So you really got to have some players on your bench that matter. And so I wanted to have a flat build, and I didn't want to be spending over $40 for any one player. So that's where I started. When I got done with my par sheet, I didn't have more than $36 allocated for any one position. And that's really how I want to do a draft like this that's really deep and a really tough room. So here was my par sheet. And I know it's going to be difficult to keep this in your head, so I'm going to try to remind you as much as possible as we go through. For quarterback, I allowed $12. This is a $200 cap. Don't forget, $200 cap. For quarterback, $12. For RB1, $36. For RB2, $16. Once again, you know that's me. I dump out of RB2. Wide receiver 1, $35. Wide receiver 2, $23. Wide receiver 3, $14. Tight end 1, $5. Yep, really, really cheap at tight end 1. Then my first flex I had set for $14. My second flex for 16, and my third flex was 10. Now, those are some pretty strong flex numbers. I mean, I'm devoting $40 of my 200 on those three flex spots, but that's really what I want to do because in this league, that's where you pay dividends is having that team that's so deep and so lacking of a hole in your lineup that you're going to dominate the other teams. On my bench then, for my top bench spot, I had $8. For my next bench spot, $4, then $3, then $2, and then I had $1 for my last two bench spots. Now, I was hoping, I don't love that 2-1-1 at the back of my roster for my last three bench spots, but I was hoping to have some extra dollars to put towards those last couple spots, and that is actually, in fact, what happened. So QB1, 12, RB1, 36, RB2, 16, wide receiver 1, 35, wide receiver 2, 23, wide receiver 3, 14, $5 for tight end, and then 14, 16, and 10 for my flex. Okay, so that was my plan. I didn't have any money allocated over $36 for any one player, and I really wanted to get a lot of wide receivers. So that's, you know, that's not an unusual plan for me or an unusual build for me. I really wanted to have only four running backs. Now, if I got more because they were cheap or because my plan shifted, that's fine, but I was only planning on getting four running backs if I could get four solid ones, and I wanted to be able to flex one or two of them. Now, I usually want to flex the wide receivers, but one of the major points that I have for you, and I want you to think about, is when I went into the preparation this year, I remembered that the wide receivers were getting more popular last year. I talked about it prior to draft season, and it turned out to be true, and it's been true again so far this draft season. Wide receivers are getting more popular. Now, I still believe generally that in an auction, you can buy wide receiver points cheaper than you can buy running back points. I still believe that. But the gap is closing, and more people are choosing to fill their flex spots with wide receivers So the prices aren't falling off a cliff as much as perhaps you would think they would. So I wanted to get a lot of wide receivers, but I was open to the idea of getting four solid running backs instead of three and flexing a couple of running backs, and that's not normally what I do. So I was going to be open to that idea. The other idea I had was that I was going to be open to flexing a tight end, and that is, in fact, what I ended up doing. Now, I got lucky because I got Mike Gesicki for a dollar. Everyone hates him so much, and I understand in a 10 or 12 teamer that you're not really going to go after Mike Gesicki, but in a deeper draft, I got Mike Gesicki for a dollar. I mean, that's stupid. I'm not saying that he should be seven, but he should be $3-4 player. And I understand people are concerned about how much he's, you know, going to see the ball. But in a more efficient offense that can run the ball and in a different offense, we don't really know what's going to happen with Gesicki. And I can't believe he's just going to disappear completely. So $1 for him and $4 for Njoku. We'll talk about that a little bit. But I love that I spent $5 on two tight ends that I like instead of five on one that I like, and I could possibly flex one of them. So that was my par sheet, and that was my plan. How did I do in executing my plan? Well, if you had to ask me and you said, yes or no, did you execute your plan? I would say absolutely yes. Categorically, undeniably, yes. I executed my plan, and I think I did it fairly well. In fact, you know, it's actually a little bit scary how much I like my team. That's not usually a good sign because more often than not, when you hate your team, I mean, I was despondent 2 years ago when I came out of the draft during the COVID year when we were online, and I just thought that I absolutely botched that draft. I ended up winning the league. So I don't know. I'm a little scared about how much I like my team, but let me tell you what I ended up doing with my team. And then I'm going to tell you three things that happened that I sort of thought were not necessarily big mistakes, but inflection points for my team and my draft that sort of nerfed the nuclear upside that I could have had on my team. I think I made three fairly significant miscalculations that took my team from being nuclear, top of the line, absolutely crushed it, to, yeah, that's a pretty good team. And there's a big difference there. I think there's a huge difference there. So let me tell you who I ended up with and their prices. Again, I know you're not going to be able to keep track of all this, but it gives you a general idea of how I executed the plan. At quarterback, as we went through the draft, I began to realize that my price of $12 was going to be a little bit off. More than in any other years past, the quarterback prices just stayed pretty steady, and they were very consistent above $12. In fact, most of the top 6 to 7 quarterbacks went for $16 or more. And so when I had 12 set out, I thought, you know, there really isn't any reason to force this. I'm going to get a quarterback I like at some point for cheaper than this amount. Now, I think Tom Brady ended up going for 11, Dak Prescott for 11. Those aren't bad prices, but I really felt like, what's the point of paying for those when I can get another guy that's going to be $2, $3, $4, $5? And I missed out on sort of the quote-unquote elite guys like Kyler Murray, Jalen Hurts, Justin Herbert, Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson, Josh Allen. All those guys went for 16 or more. Most of them went between 18 and 20 bucks. Josh Allen all the way up at 23. So our quarterback, I thought that it might be a little bit weird. It did turn out to be a little bit weird. I had $12 allocated. Somebody nominated Matthew Stafford for $1. The room was silent, and I said, two, you know, with like a question mark, like, why is nobody bidding? I ended up with Matthew Stafford for $2. I thought that was really weird. I know people have an issue with the elbow. They're a little bit scared, but $2, come on. Guy threw 36 touchdowns or 38 or whatever the hell he threw last year. $2, like, come on. So at that point, no, I'm not impervious to the idea that Stafford may have a problem down the road. So I wanted to get another guy. I was looking at the board, and I was like, okay, I'm going to get somebody like Trey Lance or, you know, Kirk Cousins or maybe even Aaron Rodgers or Justin Fields, somebody like that. Didn't turn out that I wanted to spend a bunch of money on Trey Lance, and I didn't want to get somebody like Cousins when I have Stafford. I wanted to get a little bit different mold. So I went for Fields, and I got Fields for $6. I absolutely love the combination of Stafford and Fields. They're two very different quarterbacks with different possibilities. And what's great about it is I had $12 set aside, and I spent $8 on both of them. So I gained $4. Bam. Plus four on the par sheet. All right, moving right along. At running back, I had 36 allocated for running back, and I paid 38 for Aaron Jones. We're going to talk a little bit about how that was a big moment in my draft. RB2, I had 16 allocated. I paid 14 for Elijah Mitchell. I'm not a Mitchell guy, but I will say this. In this kind of a draft where there is no depth on the wire and where you don't really have a choice on whether you start the guy or not, you know, if you're in a 10-team league, you're looking at Elijah Mitchell like, do I really want to stick this guy in the lineup this week? Because he's not going to catch passes. He has to score twice to be worth it. But in this league, he's money. You just stick him in there. You don't worry about he's going to have some bad weeks. He's going to have some spike weeks. You don't worry about it. It's easy. I also ended up with Kareem Hunt for $14. He fit nicely in my flex spot that I had allocated for $14. And then I got Cordarrelle Patterson for $12, and I had a flex there for $10. So I paid about $2 more than I wanted to there. But that gave me four solid running backs: Aaron Jones, Elijah Mitchell, Kareem Hunt, and Cordarrelle Patterson. I think those are fantastic running backs for this format. Absolutely fantastic. I paid 38, 14, 14, and 12, and I love it. At the wide receiver position, I had 35 for my wide receiver one. DJ Moore ended up being my wide receiver one for 32. I regret that a little bit. Not that I regret paying for DJ Moore. I regret the price a little bit, and we're going to talk about that. That was another inflection point. For wide receiver two, I had 23 allocated. Ended up spending 25 on Brandon Cooks. And then for wide receiver three, I had 14 allocated. I ended up spending $13 on DeAndre Hopkins. Now, because I took Hopkins, I knew that I wanted to get another reliable wide receiver three for a little bit more than that. And I actually ended up spending $16 on Hunter Renfrow, and I had allocated $16 for a wide receiver in my flex spot. So nailed that perfectly. And what I really loved about going through the draft was the values that I got were almost exactly what I wanted to pay pre-draft. And that means that I was really dialed in to what my room was going to do. And Doug and I are going to talk about it a little bit, but we could hear the other room drafting, and there was some volatility in that room where players were going for $60 to $65. A lot of players were going for above $40 and $50. And that meant that the prices bottomed out a little bit more in that room. But in my room, I knew that there was going to be some predictability year to year because we didn't have a lot of new drafters in there. And I knew that people were going to go for the wide receiver, so that I was going to have to allocate that $14 to $18 range. It ended up working out great that I got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 players between $12 and $16 that I value as strong flex or decent RB2 wide receiver three type players. So then on my bench, I ended up with KJ Osborne for $7, Jarvis Landry for $6, Van Jefferson for $1, Jamison Crowder for $3, Mike Gesicki for $1. And of course, like I said, I got Justin Fields, and my starting tight end is David Njoku. I don't love my tight ends, Njoku and Gesicki, but they're going to be fine for this type of league. Everybody's going to have a little bit of hole. But you have to find 8 players, 2 running backs, 3 wide receivers, and 3 flex, 8 players to stick in your lineup every week. I believe that I have a pool of 10 that I can pick from, and I think that's fantastic coming out of a draft like this. So don't get me wrong. I feel pretty good about what I did. It's just that it's always the what if with me. And I hope that you understand that you're never going to come out of an auction draft with a perfect draft. But I hope you come out of the draft with the hunger that I have to say, I didn't quite get that right. Here's how I could have got it right. And here's how I could have made a pretty good team a great team. So I have 3 different things that happened to me that were turning points in the draft that I think sort of went against me. The first one of those is one that I referenced before, and that's the Joe Mixon and Aaron Jones thing. So I ended up getting Aaron Jones for $38. And when I did that, I actually was fine with that price because I had said 36, 38 is fine, totally fine. I like Aaron Jones. I think he's a back end RB1, and I think he's going to catch 50 passes. Absolutely love Aaron Jones for that price. That is exactly what I want to do with my RB1 in a league like this. I don't want to be paying in the 40s, and I want to get a back-end RB1 like I did last year with Austin Eckler and hope they can jump up into the top 6. So I love the price and I love it in a vacuum. The interesting thing was I went for Aaron Jones at that price because I looked at the last couple running backs that were left and realized, oh no, it's getting thin. And I realized it just a touch late, not too bad, but I realized it and thought, if I don't go for Jones now, I'm going to have a problem getting a running back for a reasonable price. And the guy I was looking at was Joe Mixon. And I really thought that I was going to end up with Mixon as my one. But when I saw this developing and then somebody else called out Aaron Jones, I thought, I think that I should probably get Aaron Jones here so that I don't get stuck getting bid up on Joe Mixon. Because I really thought that the competition for Mixon was going to be off the charts because he literally was like the only one left in the top 15 after Aaron Jones. So what I did was I followed the advice that I've been giving all summer, and I said, I got to get Jones if it's a reasonable price. If not, I'll just hope I get Mixon for a reasonable price. Probably not. I'm probably going to end up getting bid up, so let's try to get Jones. I get him for 38. I'm pretty happy about it. And then Mixon comes up not long after and goes for $32. Folks, I was pissed. I was pissed. And I wasn't even that upset at anybody except myself, because when I looked at it afterwards, I thought, well, why did that happen? Why did he go for 32? Why didn't the scarcity push the price up any further than it was? And I came to the conclusion that it was pretty simple. I underestimated the amount of money that had already been spent in the room. I was underestimating the fact that there were so many players in the room that already felt like they had the running backs they need and could not afford to spend $32 because they had enough other holes to fill as the draft was going on. I think that's a fairly big miscalculation. I got the first part of the equation right, which was to try to land a guy before scarcity kicks in. But I missed wildly on the second part of the calculation, which was, is there enough money in the room for that price spike to even happen? And the answer was no. So that's a pretty big miss on my part. And it's not that big of a deal because in the end, I still like my team, but $6 at that point is fairly significant for a guy that you could argue is probably going to be a 350-touch guy versus a guy who's going to be a 260-touch guy. Of course, I'd rather have Mixon. Goal line, workhorse. Of course, $6 difference makes a difference. Because then if I could have gone and put that $6 on my wide receiver two at Brandon Cooks, I could have spent up and got a better wide receiver too. So it had a domino effect because I miscalculated the amount of money in the room. There wasn't enough money for scarcity inflation to take place because there just nobody was going to be willing to do that. Had I been more dialed in, had I been more aware of the lack of dollars in the room, I might have got that one right and I might have ended up with Joe Mixon cheaper than Aaron Jones. The second part of my draft that I didn't like, an inflection point that again went against me, was when I was trying to get my wide receiver one. We had gone fairly deep into the draft and a lot of the top wide receivers were gone and I wasn't finding the price that I liked. That $35 price was a little bit off because I wasn't able to get a wide receiver for that number. They were all going above that number or falling well below that number. So that 35 appeared to be kind of like a nice little mean, like a nice little average, but not really that accurate for landing what I wanted to land. So when it got to DJ Moore, there were five guys left that I felt like were fairly similar guys in the same tier. That's Mike Evans, Tyreek Hill, DJ Moore, Keenan Allen, and T. Higgins. Now, I know a lot of people don't have DJ Moore in that tier, but you know, at this point, look, that's not the conversation. The conversation is if I've got these five guys in a tier, I want to make sure that I get one of them. And what I thought to myself was, well, if I can get one of them for the low 30s, I think I have to jump on it because I don't think that I want to spend 37 on one of these guys. So my valuation ahead of time on my parsheet of wanting to spend 35, I didn't think that was going to be accurate. So I thought, let's get one of these guys for low 30s. And I was really hoping that I would get Keenan Allen for low 30s. But DJ Moore comes up, and Tyreek Hill had already gone for, T. Higgins had already gone for $36. And DJ Moore comes up, and the bidding stops in the low 30s. I end up bidding 32 for Moore and getting him at 32. Now, after Higgins and Goff for 36, I felt pretty good about Moore. Now, I'm of the opinion that he's going to break that 4-touchdown ceiling this year with Baker Mayfield, and that just a little bit better quarterback play is going to make him take off and be a wide receiver one. So that's my opinion on DJ Moore, but I felt okay about that 32 after the 36 for Higgins. But then what ends up happening is Keenan Allen comes up right after DJ Moore, and he ends up going for 31. Now, not that big a deal. It's just $1, but I would rather have Keenan Allen than DJ Moore. And I actually bid up to 30 bucks on Keenan Allen because even though I'd only allocated 23 for my wide receiver two, I thought, well, if I can get Keenan for 28, 30 bucks, I'm going to do it, and I'm just going to pull the money from somewhere else. Well, then somebody ended up bidding 31, and then I thought, if I pay 32 for Allen, I'm almost $10 over what I wanted to spend on my wide receiver two. I don't think I can do that. I've got him up in the low 30s, close to more, and I think I just have to back off. That's one of those things that we talked about before. I was market price enforcing. I was also okay with getting Keenan, but I was price enforcing there just to make sure that he got close enough to Moore that I didn't want to drive into a bridge on my way home. So Keenan goes for 31. And then not long after that, this is remarkable to me, but this is a hallmark of our room. Mike Evans went for $32 and Tyreek Hill went for 32. I mean, it doesn't get much more rock solid than that. And I chalk that up to this being a really veteran room. They're just not going to go crazy, and they're going to know their valuations. So when Higgins went for 36, Moore 32, Keenan 31, Tyreek 32, Evans 32, all in the same tier, all within $5 of each other. That's remarkable, and it's just a testament to the drafters in the room. So I wasn't excited to get what was arguably the lowest guy in that tier for 32 bucks, but I didn't hate it because I frankly think that there's less risk with DJ Moore than there is with Tyreek Hill this year. So I really wouldn't want Higgins at 36. The ideal buy in that tier was Keenan at 31, or I would have rather had Evans than DJ Moore as well. But for the price, I think I got the third best result of those five wide receivers. That's okay. That's okay. But I was, again, when you're talking about taking your game to the next level, I would much rather have Mike Evans for 32 or Keenan for 31. If I think that I'm going to be a next level auction player, I have to be better at predicting what's about to happen in this tier. Because I jumped on Moore thinking that the prices were going to go up. But what I didn't realize was, again, I didn't account for the fact that this is such a veteran room. It's such a solid, rock solid room. And let me say something as an aside. Well, it's not really an aside. It's more of a way of explaining this even further. I have the Draft Dominator from Football Guys. And again, I'm not here to show for Football Guys. This is my show. It's not their show. But I love the Draft Dominator. I think it's awesome. And they have something called the Dynamic Auction Price. And the Dynamic Auction Price basically goes up or down based on whether or not there's good deals or bad deals in the room. So if people are paying too much money, then that Dynamic Auction Price is going to go down because you should be able to get players cheaper later. If players are going too cheap, then that dynamic auction price is going to explode because you're going to have more dollars chasing fewer spots later. What was remarkable was in the middle of this auction draft, that dynamic auction price was almost exactly mirroring the actual value from before the draft. So a $36 player wasn't showing a $41 dynamic auction price. They were showing like a $37 price, which means that everyone in the room was sticking straight to these perfectly rock-solid values throughout the draft. It is hard to find a deal in that room. And so what I should have understood about the tiers thing, and this is, again, it's kind of an extension of lesson number one, which is that people aren't going to go crazy when they don't have the money. That's the hallmark of a home league, of a casual draft, where people see Mixon and they're like, oh, I'm just going to keep bidding even though I shouldn't really do that. And then they're going to end up spending 40 bucks and they're not going to have any money left for the rest of the roster, but they do it anyway because they can't help letting Mixon go. This room was too sharp for that. And they weren't going to ruin the rest of their draft just to market price and force on Mixon. And this is the same thing. I should have learned the lesson at this point that they're not going to go crazy on the scarcity of these wide receivers because there's too many wide receivers left. They're too smart for that. And there's not enough room, money in the room for that. So I should have been more dialed into the fact that this veteran room wasn't going to go crazy, and I could have waited for the value in that tier instead of feeling a little bit panicked that I wasn't going to get a wide receiver one. So I ended up with a sort of a mediocre wide receiver one, not sort of, definitely mediocre. I like DJ Moore. I'm totally fine with him as my wide receiver one. I'm not upset about it. It's just that the difference in him and some of the upside of a Keenan Allen or Mike Evans or T. Higgins or whatever, I think it's significant. Now, maybe it won't end up being that way by the end of the year. But again, if you're going to be a high-level auction player, I feel like the need is there for you to be more accurate in your prediction of the shifts and how things are going to move in the room. I think that was 0-for-2 on these first two big inflection points that mattered to my roster. Now, this third point that I want to make is entirely one based on my player valuation, so you may not even agree with my point. But I think the third big point in my draft was when I landed Brandon Cooks right before Allen Robinson came up for bidding. And I've been trying to do better, and I think that maybe I did this to my detriment a little bit in the Kings Classic, but I've been trying to be better at recognizing that there are deals along the way that I regret passing on just because I'm not in love with the price. And I got Brandon Cooks for $25. I'm not in love with that price. It's a fine price. I'm okay with it. I like it, but I don't love it. And what bugs me even more is that the same thing happened with Allen Robinson that happened with Keenan Allen before when I bid on DJ Moore. I just landed Moore and Allen comes up and I couldn't afford to pay for him. Same thing happened when I landed Brandon Cooks. Allen Robinson, I think he was the next receiver nominated. He ends up going for 25 when I had Cooks for 25. Now, if I didn't have Cooks for 25, I would have been in on Robinson. And as me and Doug Orth are going to talk about, Doug landed him. He would have had to pay more for Allen Robinson. Now, maybe I wouldn't have ended up with Robinson and then I would have passed on Cooks and Robinson. So hindsight's 20/20. But in this moment, I was a little bit frustrated because there was a couple guys below Cooks that I believe maybe have more upside. And one of them was Robinson. So I think that I could have waited, not bid on Cooks at 25, and then landed one of those two guys behind him for the same or lower price with more upside. So if you want to talk about having a perfect draft, I think I had a rock solid, very nice draft, but not a great draft. And again, B plus, A minus, but these three points in the draft were inflection points for me. They may not have necessarily been inflection points for anyone else, but there are points at which my draft shifted. And the draft shifted around my predictions about what was about to happen in my head. My ideas about, hey, there's about to be a shift. Hey, there's about to be a spike in the price. Hey, you're about to lose out on a deal that you should be taking. And in all three instances I've listed here, the Mixon versus Jones, the DJ Moore in the tier of five guys, and the Cooks versus Robinson and the other player, I can't remember them off the top of my head, that were going to get called out behind Cooks. I think I missed on all three. I think I was 0-for-3. And the problem is the misses there were on the top three priced players on my entire team. They represent the top three priced players, and it's not even close. I didn't pay more than $25. I paid $25, $32, and $38. Those are the only guys I paid more than $20 for in the entire draft. So if I'm 0-for-3 in my prediction of the shift or the prediction of the market and how it's going to react, well, folks, that ain't good. 0-for-3 on three big moments frustrates me. I don't think those are horrible results because I was wrong. But as I say all the time, it is about who makes the fewest mistakes. I think I made some mistakes there. And Doug Orth got a really good player for $25 because I made a mistake on Cooks and taking him and not being able to bid Doug up to like $30 or $32 for Robinson. Again, 0-for-3, it's not the end of the world, but like I say all the time, it's making the fewest mistakes, but also stacking little positive EV decisions one on top of the other. I think I made small negative EV decisions there. And maybe I lost 3-5% of my effectiveness, or maybe a little bit more, maybe 6-8%. But I think that's a significant swing. And if it could have been plus 3% and I was negative 4%, I think that 7% swing in expected value is enough to say, hey, you kind of screwed that up and you got to be better. All right. Well, we've gone a long time on that already. We're going to talk about it a little bit more with Doug, but I want to hit on one more thing before I let you go. And that thing is some stuff that happened during the draft that I want you to see actually happens, because I feel like I sit here all summer and say, this is going to happen, or this is going to happen, or that's going to happen. And you don't really know it because it's all theoretical until you get in a draft and you see it. So I want to tell you about a few things that happen that I say all the time happen. And they happen in this really, really veteran draft room. And I think that it should make you feel good about your ability to perform in a room like that, but also your ability to perform overall, because these very veteran guys, these really smart fantasy minds, made some very simple auction mistakes. The first thing I saw was, I talk about this all the time, when it's the beginning of a draft, people love bidding on the top players. They just love it. They cannot help it. They don't want to go off and have a run where they talk about wide receiver twos. They want that market set. They don't want to be discussing Elijah Moore when Jonathan Taylor's sitting on the board. All right. So that's just going to happen. And that happened in this room. We got a lot of the top talent out in the first two rounds. There were not many nominations that weren't top six, eight players in that first two and a half rounds. So that's going to happen. And I've been telling you this, I put it in my articles, just count on it. People will nominate the top guys. It's even more reason why you don't need to do it. You don't need to do it. You don't need to nominate the top guys. Nominate the people who work for you. Now, if it's a top guy, then that's fine, but nominate the people who work for you. We also had a weird nomination moment where somebody, and again, I'm not using names here because I want to be very clear. Nobody in this room had a bad draft. Everybody knows what they're doing. So I'm not here to trash people at all. I'm here to say that some people made some mistakes. I made mistakes. I'm not mistake-free. So this shouldn't be a slam on anybody, but I want to talk about a couple of those things. Somebody had a bit of a brain fart. Most of the top tight ends were going upper 20s, low 20s, mid 20s, something like that. But then there was a pretty big cliff. And guys like Goddard and Hockenson went for $8-$9. Now, that hadn't happened yet, but this guy nominates Pat Freiermuth, and he nominated him for a starting bid of $10. Now, in this room, Pat Freiermuth is probably a $4 to $6 player, maybe $7. He nominated him at $10. What would you all say that is? Everybody say it with me now. Say it with me now. He was getting fancy. Don't get fancy. Don't nominate a player like Pat Freiermuth for more than $1. What if nobody wants him and you end up with him for $3? I mean, I nominated Gesicki near the end of the draft, and I thought for sure I was going to have to pay $3, and I ended up paying $1. So I thought about nominating him for $2 just to make sure that I got him and that nobody would want to pay $3. But if I nominated him for $2, I would have wasted $1. Don't get fancy. And the guy who nominated Freiermuth, he learned real quick that that was a fancy move, and he wasted some money nominating him for $10 out of the gate. Another thing I saw that kind of blows me away, but I guess maybe doesn't, because some of these guys don't always do auctions, but several teams in the room, several. I mean, it could have been as many as 3-4 teams in the room, maybe 5. They only nominated players that they bought. They just nominated players they wanted. And I know that not everybody listens to the auction brief or reads my stuff, but man, that seems like a pretty elementary thing. You got to mix it up. You got to call out some players you don't want. You got to call out some players you do. Several teams did that. And also, several teams showed that they could be bid up repeatedly throughout the course of the draft. And again, I'm not slamming these people because they don't do auctions all the time. It's maybe not even something they're thinking about. They're thinking about their budget and what they want to do and how what players they want. And I'm not here to kill them. I'm here to tell you that if you're in that room, you can kill them. Okay? That's what we are here on the auction brief. We're the killers. We're the ones who notice this stuff. Not everybody's going to notice it, but you're here because you're going to notice it. There was one guy in particular, folks, I'm not even kidding you. I might have pulled $30 from his budget. It might have been more. Every time he wanted a player, it was really clear. He would just wait until the guy said going twice and he would bid. And then going once, going twice, and he would bid. You knew he was going to get that player. And more often than not, it was somebody that he nominated. And if he didn't nominate him, it was just clear that he knew that he wanted that player and he was going to bid. I pulled $4 from that guy every time by just making two extra bids every time. And I didn't pick up on it until maybe halfway through the draft or a third of the way through the draft. And honestly, one of the things that I have a problem with, I teach being tough and, you know, crushing people, but the bottom line is I'm an empath. Okay. I'm an empathetic person. I don't like crushing people like that. And I think after a little while, it was really easy. And you just don't ever want to be the easy mark. You don't want, you know, the line from Rounders. If you sit down at the table in the first 30 minutes, you can't spot the mark, you're the mark. Okay? If you can't spot the person that everybody's taking advantage of, they're taking advantage of you. And I kind of felt like that a little bit. Like I felt bad that I'm sort of like taking advantage of this guy. But you know what? He didn't have a lot of auction experience. I could tell when he wanted a player. I at least pulled $30 from his roster, maybe more. I mean, he was just absolutely an open book. On the other side of the coin, what I loved about this room was that it was such a sharp room that they understood how to build a roster. And I don't know if they really, you know, some of them, they probably didn't listen to the auction brief and say, well, Drew told me to build a flatter build. But these guys are intuitive, smart guys. And they came to that room with a plan that they were not going to overspend on elite players. And like I said, we could hear the other draft going on down the hall. It wasn't, you know, super loud or anything, but every once in a while we catch a snippet, Justin Jefferson, 62. And you're like, whoa, okay. Jefferson went for 46 in ours. I think he went for 60 in the other. I'm just running my mouth. But I think that it was a little disconcerting to hear the prices from the other room because everybody in our room was very aware of the fact that the top players should not go so expensive that the team who wins them couldn't come back with some depth down the road. Christian McCaffrey and Jonathan Taylor both went for $52. I think that's pretty low. And I think that's great because this is a sharp room and they understood that the elite players were going to have to be cheaper. So it begs the question, should you go for elite players in that kind of a room? And I'm not sure that the answer isn't yes, but unfortunately, I'm not a guy that likes to pay $55 for somebody and then try to build a roster. But again, everybody in the room thought that. So it's worth thinking about whether or not I could have gone for one of those elite players and still built a pretty good team. But I love that. And I think that it illustrates a perfect point that I've been saying all along. Number one, that your build has to be flatter the deeper the league goes. And number two, that the room is going to dictate what happens with your build. Because if you think, hey, I'm going to go flat build, and then everyone else thinks that, maybe you should switch it up a little bit. Now, in this room, I'm not sure that I still agree because I don't want to pay that $50+. But I think it's worth thinking about the fact that if you're in a veteran room, a sharp room that's going to see that advantage, you have to think about being fluid in that moment. The last thing I want to talk about is I think it was pretty interesting that one of the things I've been preaching at all summer came true, and I absolutely love it, and that's how I'm going to end my portion of the show this week. Mike Evans was the last player in the tier that I was talking about before with the five wide receivers. And what's interesting about that point in the draft was that Evans was also one of the last top guys in the top 15, 16, 18 receivers. He was going to be one of the last guys to go, period. And I thought to myself, well, should I try to wait and maybe get Evans for like $27? Maybe that's going to happen. Maybe I'm going to get a deal on him that I didn't think I was going to get. Or should I nominate him and try to land him now? I was playing back and forth with it in my head, and something happened that I thought was awesome. He got nominated as I was thinking about it. And why do I think that's awesome? Well, I don't think it's awesome because it took it out of my hands. I think it's awesome because it says something that I say all the time. Why do you need to waste your nomination on Mike Evans? Unless it's a timing issue, unless you believe the timing is correct for you to do it. Okay, that's the exception. But why do you need to waste your nomination on Mike Evans? Do you think that other people aren't going to nominate him? No, because as I was thinking about Mike Evans being one of the last wide receivers left, somebody nominated him. That's how it goes. As I was thinking about whether to do it, it happened. So something I've been saying all summer long is leave Mike Evans on the board for somebody else to do your dirty work. You don't have to worry about getting that out there. You can pick something else that helps your build at that point. And there's no reason for you to do that. It was a perfect illustration. I loved it. When I saw it happen, I said, yep, that's exactly what I've been saying. And I hope that you're taking that to heart. All right. Well, I've been talking long enough about the King's Classic draft, but I hope some of this stuff is helpful to you because it illustrates the fact that a lot of this stuff that I'm talking about absolutely comes into play. And a lot of our alertness and attentiveness during the draft is going to help us predict what's going to happen. And if we're vigilant, paying attention to all the factors, not like me being 0-for-3, but if we're paying attention to all the factors and predicting things correctly, we're going to be able to take advantage of the room and we're going to be able to have a monster draft. I was a couple small but impactful decisions away from having a monster draft in a room full of really tough drafters. All right, thanks for listening to that part. I hope it was helpful. I didn't sit here and talk about my own team and myself for the whole time because I think it's fun, although I do think it's fun. I did it because I think that you will benefit from those lessons and those things that I did that weren't necessarily optimal, positive EV plays. So I hope you got a lot out of that. Doug and I are going to continue the discussion on the King's Classic on the other side because, once again, I think this is valuable stuff. And let's get on with it. This week's discussions with Drew and Doug Orth from FF Today.
Time for Discussions with Drew. In-depth conversations with the brightest minds in the fantasy industry.
Welcome into this week's Discussions with Drew. This week I have for you a dear friend of mine from the fantasy community. His name is Doug Orth, and that's how you can find him on Twitter, at Doug Orth, O-R-T-H. He also writes for FF Today. And Doug's been in the King's Classic with me. I think actually he predated my involvement in the King's Classic. So I guess I've been in with him since 2019. And we just wrapped up another King's Classic this past weekend. It was great seeing Doug up in Canton this year. Doug, how are you doing? Thanks for coming on.
Still reveling in the excitement that was the King's Classic and the Expo and doing very well. Thank you.
Yeah, it was a fun weekend. It's one of those weekends where, you know, I look forward to it all year. Then it goes by in the blink of an eye. But yeah, we had a great time. We're going to talk about the King's Classic, but I want to talk to you a little bit about what you got going on. You're with FF Today. What are you doing for them? And, you know, where can we find your work? What's going on over there?
Yeah, I've been with FF Today since 2006 and in the industry, the fantasy industry since 2000. Pretty much, during spring, I'll do draft profiles for them. I'll write up 12 to 15 of the top prospects, and then I'll do actual individual profiles for them, and then I'll do write-ups on 20 to 30 more prospects, just so I have the rookie base covered for the website. Kind of there, I guess you would say, if we have a lead auction guy, I'm that guy. If we have a lead dynasty guy, I'm usually that guy. And so I've got my hand in pretty much everything with the website.
Well, that's cool, man. And you do some high-stakes auctions, don't you?
High-stakes auctions. I'm not able to find anything more than $200. I wish I could, but I haven't been able to find anything that I'd like to do. I don't like tight end premium. I don't like super flex. So that kind of negates my market a little bit. But, yeah, I know I'm in two later this month and early next month. I'm hoping to get a few more.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that about the Superflex. I feel the same way. It's not that I won't play in a Superflex. Well, let's talk a little bit about King's Classic because this is now our fourth year of drafting together in the King's Classic. And I think that the room probably gets tougher every year. I think that proved to definitely be the case again this year. It is an extremely challenging way to do an auction. And it's something that, as of a couple years ago, I did not have a lot of experience with that deep of a starting lineup. We also have a little bit of a short bench, so we only get 6 bench players, even though we're starting 10 position players. So that's the setup. It is a challenging room. We got a $200 cap, and had you on the show after the King's Classic because I respect your auction game, and, of course, you were on the auction panel at the Expo for me as well. But let's just go like my brain works. Let's go big concepts to little. And how did you feel overall about how you performed in the auction at the King's Classic?
definitely strong where I want to be strong at, running back and receiver. Justin Jefferson, who I know we'll talk about at various points throughout the next few minutes. He was my overall receiver one, and Allen Robinson, who I know we know intimately. He's currently my wide receiver 11 overall. So I'm very high. I think those are two wide receiver ones for me. Russell Gage, I believe, is a low-end wide receiver three, and someone I believe will have more full-season value than most expect, especially after the addition of Julio Jones. While I strongly believe the Bucs won't throw 700 times again this year, I do think they'll still finish around 650. So there's more than enough opportunity for all four main receivers to eat. I could end up being weak in the flex if I end up being wrong about Romeo Doubs and or Paris Campbell gets hurt again. However, I think just about every manager in this league would complain about a high potential liability or two in the flex.
Yeah, it's really hard. It's really hard to come out of the draft with a team that, you know, that you don't have a hole somewhere. Let me tell everyone who's listening a little bit about your team here. You've got Tom Brady at quarterback. I'm just going to hit the top of the roster.
Sure.
You've got DeAndre Swift and A.J. Dillon, Lynn Gordon backing up. And then we've got Justin Jefferson, Allen Robinson, Russell Gage, Marvin Jones, Paris Campbell. And then you also managed to land Kyle Pitts as well. And I want to talk about that a little bit. But let me ask you this. When you go into this draft, what is your plan generally? And specifically this year, what was your plan? And did you feel like you executed it well?
I would probably say I was trying to follow three guidelines. And I mentioned some of this stuff during the auction panel. One, get my guys to spend a little bit less at running back than I usually do in the Kings Classic. And three, make sure I come away with a strong receiving core. And if you don't mind, I'd like to go into explain each of those briefly if I could.
Yeah, for sure. Let's hear it.
Okay. Before every auction, I try to identify roughly 50 players at different valuation levels that I believe can will serve as good foundation for my team. Of course, I allow myself to deviate from those players if I feel like I'm getting a bargain. You mentioned Kyle Pitts. I think he's an example of that at $21. I figured he was going to be way too buzzy to land in this in either the auction or the stake. I ended up getting them in both. But I adjusted quickly when it became clear most of the managers didn't want to spend that kind of money at tight end. As far as number two and card number three, almost every year I come to the Kings Classic, my goal is to build a strong foundation of running back. I believe I've come to the realization that I have to attack this 14-teamer a bit differently than I would a typical 12-teamer. As I mentioned in our auction panel on Sunday, a 14-teamer almost pushes you to build an anti-fragile lineup. Last year I somehow came away with Ezekiel Elliott and Chris Carson in both my drafts. As we know that my hope this year was to spread out the risk a little bit more by acquiring two high upside RB3 types like A.J. Dillon and Melvin Gordon. Little did I expect to end up with both of them. I also did not expect to come away Justin Jefferson, but I did expect to get Allen Robinson at a fair price, which I feel even at $25. I know we were bidding up against each other there, but I think that was still a fair price in my eyes. I was prepared to use him as my wide receiver one. With that said, I ended up getting Jefferson $2 below my evaluation of him.
And you ended up getting Jefferson for, I want to make sure it was 46.
That's right.
And it's interesting because we could hear, this is a weird setup here. As we're drafting, about 50 feet away is the other division drafting for Sirius Radio. So we could sometimes hear who a player or what a player had just gone for in the other division. And we noticed partway through that there was a significant difference in the prices for the elite players. So the top players like Jefferson and, you know, your Taylor stuff, those kind of guys. I want to say that Jefferson went for like $60 or something in the other division, if I recall correctly.
Is that right? That's exactly what I went for, yeah.
Okay, that was a nice little guess there. But yeah, so you got, that's a significant discount, $14 between the other room and this room. And I don't know if that's what, maybe it's due to there was a couple new auction drafters in the other room and maybe they went a little bit more crazy. What is your thought about why the significant difference in price there?
No idea other than maybe just I've read and I've heard with some of these quote unquote expert drafts that people want to make a statement with their guys and whatnot. To me, and we'll talk, I'm sure we'll talk about this later, it's kind of irresponsible in my eyes to go 60-plus, and I 60-plus on any player in a $200 cap, just because you're putting, while it might pay off, you get a Christian McCaffrey. Yeah, maybe he stays healthy 12, 14 games, and you get the RB1 by a long distance. I don't know. But that's way too much risk on one guy. But anyway, I think it's just, we call them in today's world stands, right? Got to get my stand, right? So yeah. I think I'm going to attribute to that. I want to say, I don't want to throw a name out there, just to throw a name out there, but I think it was Andy Behrens that got him for $60 in the other division. So, but apparently he was in a bidding war with somebody. So there was certainly more than one person that was crazy about him.
It is just interesting how, because I went over some of these numbers with Bob Harris last year, and the prices weren't nearly so divergent. So that's why I say that I think that our draft was a lot tougher this year, and I think that it was probably tougher than the other room, just because I think everyone in our room realized over the last 2 years, the adjustment everyone's made is that you can't pay up for the top players as much, because if you do, then you are going to really struggle to fill those flex spots, because there's just not enough there in a 14-teamer. You know, you mentioned that earlier, that you had changed a little bit in your build, that you wanted to be less fragile and less reliant on those running backs. Is that the biggest adjustment you made from last year to this year, or has that just been a slowly evolving thing in all your drafts, or is that just King's Classic?
Yeah, the anti-fragile build is something I want to focus on in a 14 team. I don't expect to get into 16 or 18 team leagues, but if the bigger leagues, yeah, I want to build more, because depth at every position is going to be, you know, crazy thin. So I need my key guys to stay healthy, obviously. As I mentioned earlier, I wanted to avoid the Elliott Carson nightmare from last year and build a team more like the one that won the snake title going away in 2020. Last year's auction team had Josh Allen and Mark Andrews, and I was more than happy to have them. But I think I ended up with at least $61 players. And while I acknowledge building depth and stashing upside are not easy things to do in a 14-team analyst league, I did not do that well enough last year. I'm hoping between Romeo Doubs, Paris Campbell, Brev Jordan, Deontay Foreman, I think I accomplished that a little bit better this year.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. I always like to hear people's opinions about what they saw as the better teams in the room. So did you have one or two other teams that you wanted to point to that you thought did a nice job?
Well, as always, Drew, you did a great job. So, right?
Well, thank you. You know, that's not mandatory, but I'll ship you $10 later.
So, yeah, I was looking at the rosters here about an hour ago. So I'm not crazy about the upside of Chris Prince's receivers, but there's no question he has a capable starter at every one of the 10 positions.
Yeah.
And I think if Graham Barfield can get a decent year out of, you know, Benjamin in his final flex spot, or find an answer to that final flex spot, I think the rest of his lineup looks good to me.
Okay. Well, so let's talk about Chris Prince, who said capable starter in every spot. And that sometimes can be key. So Prince ended up with Josh Allen at quarterback, Joe Mixon. He paid, I want to go through these prices here, and I know it's tough for people listening, but Josh Allen, $23, Joe Mixon, $32, James Conner, $24, Breece Hall, $26. And then if we skip down to the receivers, it's Jerry Jeudy, $21, Drake London, $15, Brandon Ayuk, $16, Chris Olave, $9. And then he ended up with Hockenson for $8. So I see what you mean. You know, the receivers may be a bit limited. I don't know what we can expect. It's not as if they're bad players to put in your starting lineup, but they may be a bit limited. Let's talk about a couple of the prices that Chris paid.
Yeah.
He spent only $32 on Joe Mixon. And I thought this was an interesting point in the draft, because I ended up with Aaron Jones for $38. And when I did that on purpose, because I felt like Mixon was one of the last guys left beyond Aaron Jones. And I thought, boy, everybody's going to bid Mixon up. And then it ended up going for $6 cheaper. And I think at that point, honestly, there just wasn't enough money in the room. Were you surprised at that Joe Mixon price?
Definitely. Probably the big surprise of that draft, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. I couldn't believe that. I just don't know if there was enough money left. And I think that maybe I miscalculated there and thinking that his price was going to get jacked up.
I wanted to get in on that action too. I guess I could have sacrificed my high end RB3 stance on that and just went, you know, Mixon, Swift, and then hope that they both stayed healthy. But yeah, that was a consideration. Yeah. I know I was bidding into the high 20s. I hated to see him go for that little amount. But yeah.
Yeah. And it's just one of those things where when you're in the auction and it happens, you see it happening and you just, there's nothing you can do about it. And that I think that's how everybody was feeling at that point. He just went too late. How do you feel about James Conner for $24? We know the story on him last year was a little bit TD dependent. What do you think?
Yeah, we might get to him a little bit later in the conversation here. Uh-huh. I think for the downside that he represents this year, I think 24 is a fair price. No way do I see another 18 touchdowns. I'm not even sure he gets to 12. So it's a fair price considering the risk that is baked into acquiring the services. So
okay,
I would not want to go much higher than that.
And that was right about that spot where I thought, there's just enough guys that I'm not interested. He went before Mixon, I believe. But well, let's talk about his trio of receivers. He's got Jerry Jeudy, Drake London, Brandon Ayuk. He paid 21 for Jeudy, 15 for London, and 16 for Ayuk. I don't know how to describe it. They're solid players, but it's just super unexciting to me. How do you feel about that trio?
Yeah, and I bet if I was, I thought the same thing when I looked at those same three guys. I think I'm going to guess what he was thinking. So I think the most of the industry has accepted or wants to accept that Courtland Sutton is going to be Russell Wilson's top receiver. But that's not a lock. That's far from a lock. Jerry Jeudy is a great route runner. Kind of in the Tyler Lockett mold. I don't want to make that a Seattle Denver comparison, but it's entirely possible. If you can get, 90% of Tyler Lockett at $21 and with that, that's, and it have the same combination, the same chemistry between Wilson, that Wilson had with Lockett. You keep reading about reports about the Trey Lance and Brandon Ayuk having great chemistry right now. Maybe Ayuk ends up being that splash, that probably volatile but very much splashy wide receiver three that wins weeks for you sometimes and gives you low end wide receiver three production the rest of the time. For $16, fair enough. I'm not as high on Drake London as most seem to be, but it's hard to argue that he's going to be the top wide receiver in Atlanta. Does that mean he's getting 100 targets? I don't know. Are they going to be good targets? I don't know.
And again, the price is not that bad. I'm not objectionable prices, but not a lot of, I guess I'm a little concerned that they're all three going to be steady producers. Okay. But again, it's tough and you got to take risk. And Chris really, I thought was a very solid auction drafter. I thought that he recognized deals well and put together a nice squad, like you said. So that was one of the teams we liked. So the other team you pointed to was the Graham Barfield, Jorge Martin team. And Jorge did a nice job. He spent $52 on Jonathan Taylor, which is actually a fairly palatable price if you're going to go after Taylor. Kyler Murray's his quarterback at 14. He's got Ramondre Stevenson as his RB2 for 15. And then his receivers are really strong. Tyreek Hill for 32, Deontay Johnson for 21, Michael Thomas for 19, Gabriel Davis for 20, and then Sky Moore for 10. So he's got five receivers I really like there. And then he also ended up with Dawson Knox at tight end. So a bit of an overpay on Knox, I think, at $8. But what stood out to you about Jorge's team that made you pick him out?
I think Michael Thomas at $19 is a potentially big deal for him. Mm-hmm. And I understand we're not getting, as I think I wrote in a, I think I wrote for USA Today earlier today, one of the news blurbs, the days of him getting 145 targets are probably over. But I think if we get a fully healthy Michael Thomas, $19, we might be paying $35 for Michael Thomas next year. So that's a potentially huge bargain. That's what stood out to me. Deontay Johnson in the flex. And you mentioned the five receivers already getting Deontay Johnson in the flex. That's huge.
Yeah. And he's somebody I don't know what to think about right now because I'm fairly excited about him, but the temperature's starting to rise a little bit. Okay. Let's shift back to your team for a second. Okay. You tell me who, what you liked about your team and what you didn't like. You know, give me your favorite buy on your team, and then also the price that you liked the least on your team.
Favorite buy was would probably have been Allen Robinson.
Yeah, I wanted to keep bidding with you. You got him for 25, and I think I had just paid 32 for DJ Moore before that, and I was a little disgusted with that price.
Least favorite buy, potentially. I didn't want to spend 11 for Brady, but the quarterback prices in the room were such this year. The quarterback prices surprised me, but I wanted a steady QB, low-end QB one. I think Brady will give me at least that. I think my least favorite buy, potentially, is probably Romeo Doubs, and that because I'm taking a chance. He could be the fourth receiver in Green Bay. Could very well be. I spent $6 on him. I totally understand he could be the wide receiver four in Green Bay. He also could be a slow starter in fantasy and end up as the wide receiver one by the end of the year. I totally understand that. I try not to go for the buzz, but that might be one where I bid on the buzz. So I would say I was hoping to get him cheaper than six. So he was probably one of his favorite buys.
Yeah, I understand that. And I know the feeling because sometimes at that point you're thinking to yourself, well, where am I going to bet on some upside here? And I don't think it's a bad bet to make, but I understand not loving the price there. But yeah, I think, you know, it's funny to say that Justin Jefferson too was a huge deal, but gosh, it sure feels like it at 46 to get possibly the number one receiver at $46. But we talked a little bit earlier about how the other room was so heavy on the top players. And our room was consistently, you know, $10, even up to $15 cheaper on some of the elite players. Looking back on it, does it seem to you like, hey, maybe we should be taking advantage of this elite pricing, that it's lower than it should be? Or is that a product of everyone realizing, hey, we have to save some money for the back of our roster because this is a tough format? Are we playing it right, or should we be thinking, uh-oh, everyone else is zigging, we should be zagging?
Well, I don't personally have any regrets. I mean, we talked about Mixon, but I don't. As with any running back, he gets hurt, and that $32 doesn't seem like such a great bargain. We can spread that risk over two players. That's one reason why I went the way I did. I think the latter point you made, I think it was our room recognizing that we need to save our money to a certain degree in order to, you know, get the upside on our bench that we want, get some decent flexes. I think our room was looking at the prices in the other division versus ours. I think we did a better job of trying to win the battle of the flex, as I like to call it sometimes.
I agree with you. I think we did that. And I'm not sitting here trying to trash the other room. There's plenty of talented auction players over there, but I do think that we did a better job of recognizing how difficult it is to build down the roster. And here's a few examples of things like that early in our draft. McCaffrey went for 52. Kupp went for 45. Jonathan Taylor, 52. Yeah, that's right. Derrick Henry, 38. Leonard Fournette, 33. Jefferson, 46. Jamar Chase, 45. Barkley, 39. Diggs, 40. Eckler, 41. Najee Harris, 40. So we were all in that upper 30s to mid 40s range. And it was remarkably consistent that we all kind of, you know, that just happened that way. I thought it was interesting. Let me ask you about your wide receiver build here. Because after Jefferson and Robinson, you spent 71 on those two. And then going down on your next four guys, you only allotted or allocated $26 during the draft. Now, was that a pre-draft plan, or did you spend a little bit more on a guy or two that made you adjust in the middle of the draft?
I don't know that it was so much deliberate as it was adjusting to the plan on the fly, so to speak, especially after getting AJ Dillon and Melvin Gordon. That was a key part of, I wanted to, as much as you can in a 14 teamer, I wanted to build depth at running back. Having said that, Russell Gage was somebody I was eyeballing as a bargain wide receiver three, and the rest kind of just fell into place after that. I do think Romeo Doubs will be a factor at some point early in the season, and I'm willing to roll the dice on Paris Campbell despite your jokes.
Well, you have to. It's an obligatory Paris Campbell getting hurt joke, right? I like him, and I was a little bit frustrated that I didn't get to him first, to be honest.
I also have a pretty good feeling that I was going to get Marvin Jones cheap, and if I can get anything close to what he did last year, that'd be for I think he was a $2 bid on that. And if I can get anything close to what 70 catches and what 70 touchdowns, obviously I'm going to be thrilled with that.
Yeah, and I think that he had, you know, it was hard to catch a touchdown playing for Jacksonville last year because they had Lawrence threw 10 touchdowns or something ridiculous like that. So, you know, if Jones gets a couple more looks in the end zone and Lawrence has some positive regression here, maybe he's going to be a fantastic bargain late in any auction. And, you know, it's funny because I think that during the draft, a couple times you made a comment about whether I was bidding you up or not. We had a lot of the same ideas going into this draft. I thought I was going to end up with AJ Dillon. I thought I was going to end up with Marvin Jones, Paris Campbell, Allen Robinson. I had all the same targets here. So I think that's interesting. In fact, I'm looking here at my notes as I go through an auction. When I realize how things are going and where I'm going to be placing my money, I'll make some notes on who my guys are that I see that I feel like I can get for $1 or $2 coming up. And two of those guys were Paris Campbell and Marvin Jones. So I was a little bit frustrated that I had competition for them because I knew maybe there would be some Paris Campbell, but I didn't think there was enough money in the room for me to have to pay much on either guy. And I just ended up having to let him go. So we were definitely, feeling the same kind of guys there. Let's talk a little bit about Kyle Pitts because you got him for $21. And I just got done writing my tight end target article over at Football Guys. And I like to pick targets from all levels of pricing because I think you can have targets that are cheap and expensive and at any point, but they can be targets because you think maybe you're getting a small discount on them. And what I said about Pitts was it's very rare for us to be able to, at this point, sort of shove our chips in on a young player like that for a price that may turn out to look really nice by the end of the year. He's getting tight end 4 or 5 pricing. And if he ends up with another 1,000 yards and 6 touchdowns, we're going to look back and say, what were we doing? Why didn't we want to pay more? So how do you feel about that $21? And what do you think about Kyle Pitts this year?
In a case like with Kelce and what I believe this year is going to be Kyle Pitts, when I spend up a tight end, I want to believe that they're going to produce at a low end wide receiver one level. At that point, if I can get a wide receiver, what I think is going to be a low-end wide receiver one, for in this case, $21, that means I then need my wide receiver 3 to produce like other people's tight ends. That shouldn't be that hard to do, especially with the depth of the position. I like to play that cross-positional math. I personally have him as my tight end, too. Would not surprise me if he rivals Travis Kelce this year. But here are my thoughts on Drake London establishes himself as even the slightest threat on the perimeter, which he should. It should allow Pitts to play in line or in the slot more often. When we consider Pitts did what he did last season, 68 catches, 1,026 yards against mostly cornerbacks, it's frightening to think what he did in year 2 against slot corner safeties and linebackers.
Yeah, I also have him as my tight end too. So I thought there was a prayer that I might get him in the upper teens. But that didn't happen. So, again, we have the same ideas about this entire thing. It's amazing. We have a lot of conflicting ideas. Yeah. It's
what's funny or ironic or whatever. I've had 3 people tell me since Saturday that you and Drew were going against, you two were going bidding on the same guys. Really awful.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's true. And I felt almost like at one point, like you were going to start being like, God, is he picking on me? But we were just after the same guys, and now talking to you, it appears that it's even more the case because, yeah, we have a lot of the same valuations on players. So I think that's probably a good thing. Well, look, I could talk about the auction forever. We've done about a half hour on it. And was there anything that stuck out to you that you wanted to mention or something that happened during the draft that you thought was a little odd or noteworthy?
I mentioned before what I tend to do, and I mentioned this in the panel, that I try to look at the historical values of the draft, of at least last year's draft, if not multiple years' drafts, auctions in particular. I was surprised, based this year or from last year to this year, quarterbacks went up, the high-end quarterbacks went a little bit more than I would have expected. If our room did something that was slightly, I would get advice against, it would be that we spent up just a little bit much on quarterbacks. For the most part, we were more reasonable. We were more reasonable than the other room. And that's, again, we're not trying to rag on the other room at all. It's just that was different drafters are going to have different ideas about how to approach the draft.
Yeah, and there was some really sustained pricing on the quarterbacks that I was surprised about. It did fall off after a little while, and I got the weird Matthew Stafford for $2. I don't know how that even happened, but I think people really are nervous about that elbow. But yeah, so we had Josh Allen for 23. That was early. And then in the end of second round, Patrick Mahomes went for 18. And then in the middle of the third, Lamar Jackson for 19, Hurts for 16. Alan Herbert in the fifth went for 18. So we had some sustained pricing above $16 that I had not seen in the past. So you're right about that. Okay, at this point, we've hit what we can as far as the Kings Classic, because we could go for another hour on that, but we hit the highlights. And I want to get to your take on a couple player evaluations before I let you go. I always like to ask my guests for their thoughts about when they're drafting, what they're thinking about overvalued, undervalued, and the guys they're getting late, because I always like that little peek into my guests' mind about that stuff, because I have a tendency to not only buy into, you know, the hive mind on Twitter, but also to hit my own little rut where I'm drafting the same guys every time it gets to me. And so I need to break out of that rut a little bit, and that's why I like to hear my guests talk about that. So give me a couple guys that you think are being overdrafted right now and why you think so.
Yeah, so I came up with three of them. We've talked about two of them already, but I'll go ahead and go in a little bit more in depth here. Cooper Kupp, albeit slightly. I think I talked about earlier, I don't think he's going to be a top five or six, worthy of a top five or six pick, more maybe early, late, probably early second round. Again, not a big deal, but it is a big deal when you're talking about a first round pick versus a second round pick. I think he had 37, 39 red zone opportunities last year. I'd expect that to come down to the mid to upper 20s, which again, not a big deal, but he passed more than 14 touchdowns again. Josh Jacobs, I believe he's going to have very high touchdown upside, but I think he's going to be very hit or miss, hit or miss touchdown dependent player. The biggest backfield is going to be a committee, and I'm not sure how much receiving he has if he loses third down role. He might have 10 touchdowns, but he might have 150 carries and 20 receptions. Last guy, James Conner, we talked about him earlier. Don't think there's any way he repeats 18 total touchdowns. Gotta remember, he rushed for 752 yards on 202 carries last year. That's about 3.7 yards per carry, and he might be operating behind a worse line than he did last year. Most of his work passing game came after Chase Edmonds got hurt.
Yeah, and you mentioned something that my guest a couple weeks ago mentioned. I think it was Rich Rebar who said, not only is the line a problem, but it's a really fragile situation because they don't have a lot of depth either on the line. And then on top of that, he talked about the fantasy points that Connor was producing when he didn't score a touchdown were not pretty. And that is something to be seriously concerned about. And if you're paying a sort of third, you know, mid to late third, early fourth round price, you're assuming he's probably going to be your RB2 and you're going to be counting on him. And that may not be a wise move, but okay. I like those three. So let's flip to the other side of the coin. How about two or three guys that you think are being undervalued right now? People are not paying enough attention to.
I apologize in advance because all my following recommendations ended up on my team in this draft.
Okay.
That's how I feel about him. Allen Robinson, for all the reasons I mentioned earlier. Okay. He's going to eat into Kupp's upside, but I think he was brought in the same way that we saw Kenny Golladay explode back about 2 or 3 years ago when he was in Stafford were tied together in Detroit. I think his upside is certainly higher than Golladay's was back then. Better offense, better play caller, better threat opposite him. Allen Robinson, number one. A.J. Dillon is going to be a factor in the Packers' backfield. I think he'll be used to close out games, and he'll be much more involved in passing game than most people expect. I think it goes, and it goes without saying what his upside is if Aaron Jones gets hurt. Third guy, Melvin Gordon. I don't expect a near even split like the Broncos had last year, but I do expect something approaching 55-45. Even at 150 to 180 carries and 20 to 30 receptions, which is where I believe I have him projected at. I think Gordon pays off at his current ADP or auction value. Of course, and just like I said with A.J. Dillon, it goes without saying what he could do if Williams gets hurt. Isaiah Scholar is another guy I feel is not in that same mode. I want to get at least one of those guys on all my teams.
I love it. I like, you know, I'm a Dillon guy as well. I think it's interesting because we hear every year coaching staff say, we're going to get both these running backs on the field at the same time. And then, you know, the regular season rolls around, it doesn't happen. But we've heard a steady drumbeat of that, that maybe they're going to use Jones a little bit more split out, maybe in the slot, get him on the field at the same time. But it was interesting. Aaron Rodgers, I believe, commented on this either today or yesterday. Like, we got to get our best 11 players on the field. And I think that's really more where I'm hanging my hat rather than just say chatter from the coaching staff, because we hear that all the time. But it really is true. If you look down their offensive skill position situation, Dillon and Jones have to be two guys who need to be on the field a lot. So I'm hanging my hat on that. Okay, well, let's end it like this. We're about 45 minutes, which is perfect. That's where I like to target these interviews. So let's end with this. You're late in... I don't care, snake, auction, whatever it may be. Who are two or three guys that you find yourself leaving all your drafts with?
We already mentioned Paris Campbell. I don't care if guys burned me in the past. I bet on talents. And he's going to have a role in that offense if he's healthy. And it could be a very big one. So give me that all day in the for a $2 bid or for a 12th-round pick or whatever the case may be. Deontay Foreman, more of a hedge against a McCaffrey injury. Again, I don't believe in injury prone, but if McCaffrey's going to get hurt, then I want the guy who's going to presumably have the early down role in that offense. Yeah. I don't expect him to have a passing game role, but that Carolina line is much improved over last year and probably much improved over the last two or three years.
So, yeah, can I interrupt you there? Because I like that point. I think their line is going to be better. And don't we think at this point that they're even going to give Foreman some standalone value here in fantasy?
I think so. I made the comparison earlier this year to the first run through of Alvin Kamara and Mark Ingram, not the one that's currently going on now, but I could see that happening. Ideally, what I would like to see is for them to take about three or four carries per game off of McCaffrey's plate, have Foreman be the inside, the meat grinder, so to speak. Keep McCaffrey on the outside, it reduces level or it reduces risk of injury, and then just pray to God that those hamstrings or the ankles hold up. But I think he has flex upside even with McCaffrey health. And then the guy that I'm going to probably screw up the name on, Albert Okwuegbunam.
Okay.
After the Tim Patrick injury, I already like him anyway. He does his work after the catch. He can split the seam. He's got the speed. I think he's 4.49 speed, and he's got a quarterback that will chuck it to him if he's open. So I already like him as a low end tight end one before the Tim Patrick injury. And now you're opening up maybe 7 to 8 targets for somebody.
Yeah, and it seems to be that's a good one to pick, because I've always said that targets don't always have to be guys that are $1 or $50 or whatever. It doesn't matter what their price is. It matters what the rest of the room thinks about him. And at least in the Kings Classic, he was fairly cheap. He was only $4. And that's not a bad price for a guy with the potential to do what he does attached to Russell Wilson. Well, look, man, this has been fantastic. I feel like if we just did a 2-hour show on the Kings Classic, we could just go forever about it. That may not be as interesting to other people as it is to us, but I really appreciate your insights in the auction. I think you did a nice job this year. And, well, obviously, if we were bidding on the same guys, I think you did a nice job.
Hey, I could do worse than bid on the same guys as the two-time defending champions.
Oh, we almost went a whole show without somebody mentioning it. Goodness. Oh, man. Well, look, thank you again for coming. Remind everybody where they can find you on social media and where they can find your writing.
Yeah, so... I'm more active on Twitter than anything else, at Dougorg, Dougorg, one word.
All right. Right on. And you're writing over at FF Today, right?
At FF Today, yep.
Okay. Well, like I said, I brought Doug on because I respect his auction game and I wanted to break down the Kings Classics. So I hope we haven't bored you too much with that talk. But thank you again to Doug, one of my closest friends in the industry, and I appreciate your time this week.
I appreciate you, Drew. Thank you.
All right. That's going to do it for this week's Discussions with Drew. All right. Nice job, Doug. Thank you so much for coming on the show this week. I apologize, everyone. We had a little bit of an audio issue there. I'm not sure where that was coming from. I did my best to squelch it. I hope that wasn't uncomfortable to listen to, but Doug did a great job, and he is a great auction drafter. He does high-stakes auction drafts. He's in the Kings Classic every year. He really knows what he's doing. So give Doug a follow there at Doug Orth, O-R-T-H, on Twitter, and follow his work on FF Today. All right, well, let's get this episode across the finish line. I know we didn't have a lot of Duke this week, but we'll bring Duke back next week. We've got one episode of the Auction Brief next week for sure. I'm debating whether or not I'm going to do one the last week of August because I've got a lot going on that week, but I think I'm probably going to do two more episodes before I take a little hiatus into the season for the seasonal grind as opposed to the grind to the drafts from the Auction Brief and what we're focused on. Thank you so much for joining me. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Drew Davenport FF, on TikTok at Fantasy Football Lawyer. Go over and visit the fine folks at FightingChanceFantasy.com, and don't forget to use my promo code Auction on Underdog and get in there. There's plenty of Best Ball Mania teams still available. Get in there and try to win millions of dollars. Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you so much for listening to me talk about the Fantasy Football Expo in Canton all summer long. It's the greatest thrill of a lifetime. I hope some of you can make it next year. And if you made it this year and I didn't get a chance to talk to you much, I hope we can connect next year. I had a blast. It is literally the thrill of a lifetime. All right, everybody, thank you so much for joining me. Don't miss next week's episode where we're going to talk about how to walk through an entire auction draft. It is one of my favorite episodes of the summer where I walk you front to back on how to attack your auction draft. It's going to be an awesome episode. Hope to see you next week. That's going to do it for episode 36 of the Auction Brief. We are now adjourned, and I am out.
The Auction Brief is adjourned. That'll do it for this week's episode. See you next time on the Auction Brief.